explain what that is?
And we just have 30 seconds, Sharif.
It's unclear, but according to the Washington Post, the human rights conditions, and they spoke to unnamed officials, said it include ending this decades-long prosecution of the leading human rights NGOs in Egypt, as well as dropping charges or releasing 16 individuals. We do not know the names of these individuals or their identities as they remain classified.
We're going to leave it there, but if you can both stay on, we're going to do a part two of this conversation. We've been speaking with Sharif El-Quddous, Democracy Now! Correspondent in Cairo, and Mada Masr, reporter, and Leila Swef, professor of mathematics at Cairo University, mother of jailed activist Ala Abdel Fattah. Happy birthday to Robbie Caron. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcast, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, when Oregon could reach herd immunity from the coronavirus, and how many more deaths are likely before then. A memorial service and a demand for justice after a young man's life is cut short by local deputies. And watch out for a contaminated item you may have picked up at the local grocery store. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 21st, 2021. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us. It was more than a memorial service. It was also a protest. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has the story.
Friends and family of Kafin Karuo gathered last night in Vancouver demanding justice for the man killed by Clark County deputies last Sunday. Karuo, a leader of the Chukis Community Church and organizer for the Chuuk community, was shot and killed by two unnamed sheriff's deputies following a car chase that ended at Northeast 49th Street and 122nd Avenue in Vancouver. The Chuuk Islands are a part of the Federated States of Micronesia, with Karuo's family originating from the island of Patah. On Tuesday, coroners confirmed that Karuo, who was 28, died from a gunshot wound to the torso. His death was ruled a homicide. At least 100 people came together to honor Karuo and demand accountability for the unnamed detectives responsible for his death. A memorial of candles, flowers, and balloons gathered near the location where he was killed and was attended by people holding signs that read, "Justice for K. Finn," and "Release deputies' names," along with items adorned with the tag K-Drop, Karuo's nickname. The two Clark County detectives who shot at Karuo have remained unidentified, though it has been reported they are both on critical incident leave, a standard practice following law enforcement shootings. Following the vigil, gatherers returned to the apartment complex where Karuo lived to host a prayer fellowship for him and his father, who sadly also passed away on Sunday. Family spokespeople maintain they will continue to gather and mourn until both men's funerals and their remains are able to be sent back to Chuuk for burial. Karuo was wanted on allegations of assault with a gun, with Clark County officials saying he pointed a gun at deputies before fleeing a traffic stop. Though police records indicate no pending charges or warrants for Karuo's arrest, no additional data has been released regarding the motivation for the deputies' pursuit and use of gunfire. Karuo's death is currently under further investigation from an independent review comprised of detectives from the Vancouver, Battleground, and Camas police departments, with those results eventually forwarded to the Clark County Prosecuting Attorney's Office for review. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Social media design fuels online fights, according to new research. Although people spend less time on average on Facebook than some other social media sites, the vast majority of users say they've had arguments there. Eric Tegedoff talks to an expert here in the Pacific Northwest.
Constructive conversations online can seem few and far between.
Research from the University of Washington explores how the design of social media sites affects disagreements. Amanda Bond, a PhD student in computer science and engineering at UW, helped lead that research. The research showed that spending more time on a site did not correlate to more arguments. But Bond says arguments are common on sites like Facebook, where the goal can be to win for whatever audience is reading the posts.
There's not really a way to scale back what is happening between two people or a group of people in the comment section. It can get very heated very quickly.
Bond analyzed what percentage of users of certain social media sites said they had arguments. 70% of Facebook users said they had argued on the platform. Sites like Twitter and YouTube were considerably lower, with 30% and 6% of users, respectively, saying they'd argued on those platforms. Bond says the venue in which these disagreements took place also is important. More than three-quarters of people who used WhatsApp, a private messenger, said they got into arguments on the platform, but were less frustrated with their experiences. Bond says people react positively to the idea of bringing their arguments on sites like Facebook to a private space, where it can be easier to be vulnerable.
I think that replicates a lot of how we have difficult conversations in real life as well. Generally, I don't think we would choose to have it in a crowded room full of people. We would choose to find a time where it's just you and the person that you disagree with to kind of hash things out.
Bond says social media sites would need to present such an option sensitively, perhaps not introducing it for the first time while people are in the middle of a heated argument.
That could seem very creepy because it's like, oh, the social media company is monitoring what I say. So I think that how the option is presented is really important, probably having it be introduced when there's not an argument.
And Bond would like to see social media companies think about individual users' experiences when designing their platforms.
Especially in the past year with the pandemic, so many of our relationships were carried out online, and making a bit of a shift towards emphasizing the relationship in addition to the user could be really beneficial.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Congress passed Savannah's Act in 2020 as an effort to improve data collection on cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women. As Suzanne Potter reports, today marked an online summit on the crisis.
Today, a virtual summit hosted by the Las Vegas Mayor's Faith Initiative looks at the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women in the United States. The National Crime Information Center reported more than 5,700 missing Native American women and children in 2016. Lynette Grable with the group Not Our Native Daughters will speak at the summit. She says the wall-to-wall coverage on the search for Gabby Petito stands in stark contrast to cases involving missing Black or Native American victims.
There is a huge discrimination when a person of color who goes missing, they just don't have the same attention, whether it's from media or whether it's from law enforcement or whether it's from search and rescue.
According to the CDC, homicide is the 6th leading cause of death for Indigenous women, and rates of violence on reservations can be up to 10 times higher than the national average. Sign up for the summit at the Las Vegas Mayor's Faith Initiative website. Taisha Wood works with the federal Amber Alert in Indian Country program to speed up response times by making sure tribal, state, and local law enforcement are on the same page.
We want the tribal communities to be empowered to be able to say, we know what to do if a child goes missing in our community. They have the resources. They have the contact information. They have the plan in place.
Della Frank, Indian Education Coordinator for Clark County School District, notes that social and economic factors vary widely for Indigenous people in urban versus rural areas. In addition, Nevada is home to 20 different tribes, and there are hundreds nationwide.
And you can't just stereotype them and generalize with them because there's 574 different cultures, languages, governments, and judicial systems.
In 2019, President Donald Trump created the Presidential Task Force on Missing and Murdered American Indians and Alaska Natives, which is coordinating a federal response known as Operation Lady Justice. For Nevada News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Recent reports from Oregon Health and Science University predict that Oregon may be on track to reach herd immunity against COVID-19 before the first of next year. OHSU data scientist Dr. Peter Graven has been tracking the virus since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. His latest model suggests that the state could reach herd immunity by as soon as December 26th. Herd immunity describes when a virus is no longer able to circulate, either due to populations being mostly vaccinated or having achieved natural immunity to infection. Exact numbers to achieve herd immunity vary based on the transmissible qualities of the specific virus. Graven's data showed that at least 85% of the population would need immunity to curb the new Delta variant of COVID-19. The Delta variant arrived in the U.S. earlier this year. It quickly became the dominant strain of the virus nationwide, causing infection spikes and surging hospitalizations in Oregon in early September. Trends show a continual decrease in infections in the state since then. Current COVID-19-related hospitalizations are at roughly 590 statewide, and they're set to decline to roughly 240 by the end of the year. Graven's research shows that COVID-19 has already infected 34% of Oregonians. He estimates that about 177,000 more infections are likely before reaching herd immunity in December based on current vaccination rates. Metrics that track coronavirus suggest that could also mean 700 more deaths in the state due to COVID-19 before the beginning of 2022. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration reports that fresh onions are responsible for a recent outbreak of salmonella poisoning. The FDA's announcement comes a day after the CDC released a statement linking the contaminated produce to onions imported from Chihuahua, Mexico, and distributed by ProSource, which is based in Haley, Idaho. 37 states are reporting they've received the tainted onions, including Oregon. As of October 19th, the CDC has reported more than 650 cases of salmonella, with those numbers expected to grow rapidly. On Wednesday, ProSource agreed to a massive recall of the onions, which ended up on grocery bins in 5 to 50-pound mesh bags and in cartons ranging from 10 to 50 pounds. ProSource says the onions were sent to wholesalers, food service customers, and retail stores under the following brands: Big Bull, Peak Fresh, Sierra Madre, Marken First Corp, Marken Essentials, Rio Blue, Rio Valley, and Cisco Imperial. Information on specific retail locations where the contaminated produce was sent is unavailable, according to spokespeople from ProSource. The CDC is urging consumers to throw out any onions distributed by brands associated with the salmonella poisoning or any onions bought of unknown origin. Specific types of onions affected include jumbo, colossal, medium, and sweet. Though no shipments from Chihuahua have been received by ProSource since late August, onions generally have a shelf life of as long as 3 months. The first reports of salmonella poisonings came in early September, but food safety officials were unable to determine the cause at that time. Symptoms of salmonella poisoning include diarrhea, vomiting, fever, stomach cramps, and dehydration, with signs of infection appearing within 6 hours and as long as 6 days after consumption. Anyone with questions about whether they may have bought or eaten the tainted onions can call ProSource's customer service line 208-928-4959 weekdays from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Mountain Time. A caregiver shortage could erase decades of progress for people with disabilities. As Mike Moen reports, advocates describe it as a full-blown crisis during the pandemic.
Advocates for Iowans with disabilities are sounding the alarm over what they describe as a caregiver crisis. The workforce shortage has been building for years, says Tucker Cassidy, a person with quadriplegia from Waterloo. But in the past month and a half, it's gotten much worse. He says it's difficult for the agency he works with to send over enough caregivers to help with his daily routine. Stuck in bed more than he's used to, Cassidy says the shortage leaves him worried about his future.
Is this going to be the week that they kick me off? And then where am I supposed to go? You know, I own my own house.
Advocates say the crisis is largely driven by low wages for caregivers. According to Indeed, the average starting pay for in-home caregivers in Iowa is around $13 an hour. Lutheran Services in Iowa estimates it has been forced to reduce its client base by 350 in recent years. The shortage comes as Iowa touts a budget surplus of $1.25 billion. Matt Grillo of DeWitt has used a wheelchair most of his life due to a spinal injury. He's been in his own house for the past 18 years, but he struggled to hire a caregiver in recent months, forcing him to consider alternatives he would rather avoid.
I have broken down within the last month and started looking at nursing homes and group homes.
But he says he faces barriers in moving to those places, adding to his stress in planning his care. Cody Luton directs Lutheran Services' statewide support program for people with disabilities. He says they're down roughly 250 caregivers, citing the struggle to pay them enough money.
It's less than a living wage, and it's only become worse. The funding has, over the last 20 years, really has not kept up with cost of living.
The Iowa Developmental Disabilities Council says it's also concerned about the crisis, adding it will be the group's number one legislative priority next session. Mike Moen, Iowa News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on rebuilding California's wildfire-damaged communities. At 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, steady rain continuing overnight with a low around 50. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy with more showers up to a high of 57. That rain will keep coming through much of next week. Today in history, on this date in 1967, about 100,000 people gathered to protest the American war effort in Vietnam. The quote of the day is from former Senator Wayne Morse from Oregon, who said about the war, "I believe that within the next century, future generations will look with dismay and great disappointment upon a Congress which is now about to make such an historic mistake." By a vote of 229 to 202, Congress is holding Steve Bannon in criminal contempt of Congress. This comes as the advisor to former President Donald Trump is defying subpoenas from a panel that's investigating the January 6 riot at the U.S. Capitol. Other former Trump officials are agreeing to cooperate with the House panel's investigation. Trump is trying to claim that executive privilege prevents them from testifying or providing documents. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi next will send the matter to the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, who, along with Attorney General Merrick Garland, will decide whether to press charges against Bannon. If he's found guilty, he could have to pay a fine or go to prison. The Republicans block another voting rights bill. A majority of Americans believe the Supreme Court bases its decisions on politics, not the Constitution. And the White House scrambles to fix supply chain backlogs. With more, here's today's edition of 2021 Talks.
The Biden administration has just become bystanders. They don't solve any problem. The Secretary of Transportation says, oh, the supply problems are going to continue through next year. I could have heard that from CNN. Why doesn't he come up with a solution?
With more than 100 ships waiting to unload off the California coast, Florida Senator Rick Scott and other Republicans are blaming the White House for the supply chain crisis. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said he's not ruling out the possibility of easing tariffs or using the National Guard to help unload cargo. Inflationary concerns are also plaguing President Biden's efforts to pass a massive spending bill. House Democratic Caucus Chair Hakeem Jeffries and other House Democrats met with a top economist Tuesday.
The inflation that we're experiencing and we know is impacting everyday Americans across the country is connected, of course, to the COVID-19 pandemic, to the supply chain issues largely connected to the pandemic, to the shutdown to some extent that took place as a result of the pandemic, and of course, most recently, the rise of the Delta variant.
Jeffries reports inflation is not projected for the long term. As expected, Senate Republicans blocked a revised bill to overhaul federal elections.
Sadly, we have seen these moments before. I'd like to think that we have evolved as a nation, and that we would not have to return to a moment where the United States Senate would have to debate, yet in this situation fail as a body to even move forward protections as it relates to the right to vote.
That's Vice President Kamala Harris, who says the fight for voting rights isn't over. The bill would have made Election Day a holiday, set early voting standards, and tackled gerrymandering. The Biden administration is threatening to revoke the authority of three red states to enforce workplace safety rules, saying Arizona, South Carolina, and Utah are failing to adequately protect healthcare workers from COVID-19. During his confirmation hearing for U.S. Ambassador to Japan, Rahm Emanuel responded to claims he was part of a police shooting cover-up while Chicago mayor. A video of a now former officer shooting 14-year-old Laquan McDonald 16 times was not released for more than a year. Manuel said the investigation couldn't be compromised.
The moment a politician unilaterally makes a decision in the middle of an investigation, you've politicized that investigation, and more importantly, you may have endangered the prosecution in bringing somebody to justice.
Some progressive Democrats are vocally opposed to his nomination. The race for the Virginia governor's office is a dead heat. A Monmouth University poll shows former Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe and Republican nominee Glenn Youngkin both at 46% among registered voters, with Youngkin's recent rise attributed to independents. Finally, more than 6 in 10 Americans in a new survey believe Supreme Court decisions are based more on politics than the Constitution, and broad majorities want to end lifetime appointments. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
A federal appeals court hears a tax case involving a tribal casino. An Apache stronghold heads back to court to protect Oak Flat. Here's more in National Native News.
Following a court trial in June 2020, a federal judge ruled that the state of South Dakota does not have the authority to impose contractors' excise tax on the companies who renovated the Royal River Casino. The casino is owned by the Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe and is located on reservation land. The state appealed that opinion to the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals, which was heard Wednesday. Victoria Wicks has more.
The arguments before the 8th Circuit focused on balancing the interests of the tribe against the interests of the state. Assistant Attorney General Yvette LaFrance tells appellate judges that contractors working in South Dakota are licensed by the state, and whether they're working on or off the reservation, paying excise tax is a condition of that license.
The contractor's excise tax is deposited into the general fund, which is then used to fund various services that benefit the tribe, tribal members, and the contractor.
LaFrance says the state has a legitimate right to tax, even if the tribe's revenue is reduced. Rebecca Kidder represents the Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe. She says the tax is assessed against the contractor, but under industry standards, the contractor passes that expense along to the tribe. Kidder says the casino project was subject to tribal and federal regulations, not state. And she notes that the state excise tax on contractors for work done on the reservation does not go toward licensing the contracts for engineering and construction. She says that fact was brought out at the June 2020 trial.
It was uncontroverted evidence that it goes directly into the general fund of the state. None of it is set aside specifically for this project or regulation of construction.
Kidder says the National Indian Gaming Commission has the authority to regulate the casino, and not just the gambling portion of the business, but also the conditions of the facility and its construction. And she says if the casino fails to meet standards, the commission can shut it down. Kidder says the value of the casino to the people of the Flandreau tribe outweighs the state's general interest in raising revenues. The 8th Circuit three-judge panel will deliberate and release an opinion later. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Members of the Apache stronghold are in San Francisco seeking protection of Oak Flat, a sacred site in Arizona. Apache Stronghold, a nonprofit community organization, is going before the 9th Circuit Court of Appeals Friday. They're urging the court to block a copper mine slated for the sacred area, arguing the destruction of the site is a violation of the free exercise of religion. Apache Stronghold and allies held a rally Wednesday near the court. The event was streamed online. Winsler Nosey Sr. is founder of the Apache Stronghold.
Friday, the federal court is going to hear a case that's going to affect this country, Native and non-Native. Native people, our religion is going to be wiped from the face of the earth. Don't think that your religion is safe on any reservation, because when this passes, it sets the course for the next 100 years.
A day of prayer is being held in the Bay Area Thursday, and a public listening session is planned Friday as the case goes to court. Resolution Copper and those in support, including top political leaders in Arizona, say it will create jobs and have an economic boost. This week, the Senate passed an act which included a one-year extension for tribal governments to utilize COVID-19 relief aid. The deadline of December 2022 would allow tribal governments additional time to use CARES Act funds. The bill now heads to the House for further consideration. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Students need more career readiness to reduce disparities. As Lily Bulkey reports, that's the finding of a new report from the Georgetown University Center on Education in the Workforce, which shows that the last three recessions have deeply affected young people.
As finding a career becomes more difficult for young people, a new report says the U.S. needs a more comprehensive approach to supporting them through their school years and into the working world. The study from the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce shows how pressures have been building on youth for decades. People used to be able to launch their careers in their 20s. Today, most don't get there until their 30s. Monty Hulse works on college and career readiness programs for the Indiana After School Network. He says in recent years, school curriculums have become less flexible.
While there's also the expectation that they would be taking on some of the career and college preparation that they don't have time and often they don't have the staff to do.
He says that's where certain after-school programs can come in, but not all students are able to access them. The report recommends more widespread coordination to ensure students truly are ready to move to the next stage. Report author Tony Carnevale at Georgetown University says that starts with making sure kids have the same access to education, starting with preschool. He says disparities remain in educational outcomes and test scores, and they translate to income disparities for young adults.
Education and the economy are now linked much more strongly than they used to be, so we're getting attempts to connect the dots between the silos in the American education system and labor markets.
The report says Black and Latino youth have higher unemployment rates than their white peers and are more likely to be neither employed nor enrolled in school. Carnevale thinks the Biden administration's Build Back Better Act could help close those gaps earlier in life by making preschool available to all families at no cost and providing more support for the most disadvantaged students in grades K through 12. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. This is Lily Wolke with Indiana News Service.
Happy International Credit Union Day. It is the 73rd such special day. Eric Tegedoff spoke to a local expert who says that the theme this year is building financial health for a brighter tomorrow.
Millions of members around the world, including some Oregonians, are observing International Credit Union Day today. This year marks 73 years of International Credit Union Day. These not-for-profit financial institutions stretch across 118 countries. John Maroney is with Canopy Credit Union in the Northwest.
International Credit Union Day in general is just really a day to celebrate our movement and the impact that credit unions have had, both for their members and then also the communities that they serve.
More than 2.2 million Oregonians are credit union members. There are more than 120 million members nationwide. To celebrate, credit union employees across the Northwest are volunteering for community and service projects. Maroney sees credit unions as being especially beneficial in the early days of the pandemic, when the economy was in flux and many people weren't able to work.
A lot of credit unions were offering things like, hey, connect with us if you're needing to skip a couple of loan payments, or if you're needing to just work out an arrangement for payments on loans, or if your account's negative, things like that. Just really embracing the fact that our members own our credit unions.
International Credit Union Day is also when the institutions set their agendas for the coming years. The World Council of Credit Unions aims to digitize its organizations around the world in the next 4 years with its Challenge 2025 goal. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 21st, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, Mike Moen, and Lily Bulkey. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give
or text KABU to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth report on how California communities are trying to recover from devastating wildfires.